Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, September 11th, 2024. Section A. Midland's pioneering past powers the next space era. Space Nation is building a testing ground for space exploration by Mella McEwen, oil editor. From arid, barren land, the pioneers who settled Midland over a century ago were skilled at building something from nothing. They built communities, and they built an oil and natural gas industry that today leads the world. That expertise in building something from nothing is one reason Midland is ideally suited to help build the next space era, said Kala Vahajakola, captain and co-founder of Space Nation. Beyond Midland's history of pioneering new areas and industries, Vahajakola said the skills used to build the Permian Basin oil and gas industry, skills such as geology and physics, will be needed in future space exploration. And Midland's central location, surrounded by other spaceports, is also beneficial, he said. Vahajakola addressed an audience at the Brown Bag Lunch and Lecture Series at the Petroleum Museum, where his company had held a three-day mission where 12 participants simulated building a lunar base. A similar mission is set for the first 3 days of October, and two more are planned for November, with a goal of hosting 100 such events by 2029. His company, headquartered at the Midland International Air and Spaceport, provides training for future astronauts, teams, leaders, and adventure travelers in space travel. When NASA and SpaceX get us to Mars and beyond, Space Nation will build and train these communities across the solar system, he told a small but engaged audience. Here in Midland, we're building that testing ground. The new space era under development is driving a space industry that is projected as a $1.8 billion opportunity by 2035, he said. And today's jobs, from doctors and nurses to lawyers, from teachers to artists and more, will be needed in space, he added. Opportunities rooted in space available to can be found in Earth observation, space launchers, satellites, data and communications management, orbital stations and infrastructure, media and entertainment, lunar infrastructure, and microgravity science research. In the near future, opportunities will be found in space manufacturing, space tourism, space solar power, space data centers, in situ resource utilization, and managing orbital debris. Further into the future, opportunities can be found in mainstream industrialization, waste disposal, solar radiation management, low gravity health, in space food production, space migration, and space biodiversity. Similar to the way technical advancements in oil and gas exploration and production led to the growth of infrastructure and development of surrounding communities. Similar advancements in space technology will lead to the growth of infrastructure and surrounding communities, he said. The darker side of creativity. From bohemian to the dark arts, enjoy Midland's vibrant art scene at 5 venues this Thursday. By Kesley Salinas. Explore the dark arts at the Midland Dark Arts Crawl Thursday at 5 different venues from 6 to 9 p.m. It's a quarterly self-guided event that is free and open to the public, though it took a brief hiatus earlier this year when it became a nonprofit organization. In addition to operating as a nonprofit organization, the Art Crawl expanded its board seats, said Liz Culp, a board member of the Art Crawl. So now we have 12 people who are making suggestions and decisions and helping out with the organization instead of just one or two. The Art Crawl will be hosted Thursday nights instead of Friday nights so that more people can participate in the event. The Art Crawl has been scheduled on Friday nights, and in the past it has occurred on nights before Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend, Culp said. Participation went down on those nights, so our crawl is now being moved to the second Thursday of the month, quarterly. Culp has also participated in the crawl as an artist, showing her paintings, which are often plein air or outdoor paintings and studio oil paintings. She started taking art classes when she was 12 and has painted full-time since retiring as a petroleum geologist in 2020. I've participated as an artist in the Art Crawl two or three times with mixed success, Culp said. If you want to sell your art, you've got to get your name and your art out there where people can see it. Culp added that each artist can showcase their art to the public at the crawl and sell it directly to any crawler who's interested in purchasing. The artist can keep 100% of the funds that they make through selling their art during the crawl. Dark Arts Crawl. The Blue Door, the Fafa Gallery, Velvet Mesquite Design, the Waystone Brewery and Board Games, and Cotton Flat Records will be hosting artists Thursday night. Each venue will have food and drinks available, either complimentary or for purchase. Crawlers can join the Dark Arts Crawl Costume Competition, and the best dressed will win a basket of goodies put together by each venue and includes a limited edition Dark Arts Crawl t-shirt. There is no specific order to attend venues. Crawl as you please. Here's what to expect at each venue. The Blue Door. Over 21. Apart from showcasing local artists, the Blue Door will be embracing the dark arts theme through their cocktails. One of the signature cocktails for the evening is called The Moon, made of red wine, creme de cassis, citrus, and edible stars. The Desert Hippie and company will also be at the Blue Door providing tarot readings to crawlers. The Fafa Gallery. Liz Culp's art will be showcased at the Fafa Gallery. Culp is also the president of the Midland Arts Association, which will be showcasing their summer show in the gallery for the Art Crawl. Over 20 local artists will be featured in the gallery, including Kathy Keller, Amanda Scruggs Art, and Sherry Thomas. The show's challenge is A Spiral is a Spring, a spiral as a tree. Show me all the things a spiral can be. Crawlers can vote for their favorite artworks in two categories, the best interpretation of the spiral theme and the best in show. The Fafa Gallery will provide complimentary refreshments. Velvet Mesquite Design. The Velvet Mesquite design will have a bohemian vibe that allows crawlers to experience art through all five senses. They will also provide complimentary food and drinks. The Waystone Brewery and Board Games. The Waystone is calling all wizards to crawl into their wizarding world. The brewery hosts the Dark Art Crawl with a Harry Potter theme, where they will have special butterbeer on tap and complimentary golden snitches that crawlers can seek and eat. There will also be craft beer, wine, mead, and non-alcoholic drinks available. Cotton Flat Records. The record store will allow art and music enthusiasts to find the best of both worlds, blending both vinyl records, live music, and visual art. Cotton Flat Records will have beer and craft sodas on tap, a food truck on site, and live music from Cella Harper. Fiddlesticks Farms kicks off fall with Grandparents' Weekend by B.K. Richter. Cooler temperatures are underway this week, and with the break from the West Texas sun comes the reminder of everyone's favorite fall activities. Fiddlesticks Farms, 5610 East County Road 120, boasts 7 acres of fun fall activities for the entire family. Jessica Norton, co-owner of Fiddlesticks Farms, said the first weekend of the farm's season will kick off on Grandparents' Weekend, September 28th and 29th. We are open to the public during the weekend on Saturday and Sunday, she told the Reporter Telegram. Tickets can be purchased online or at the door. For activities, the farm offers spider web, tetherball, sandbox, old roper, pumpkin patch, pigs races, photo props, gemstone mining, learning barn, cornfield maze, several jumping pillows, hay rides, hay jump, goat walk, giant tube slide, cow train, milking parlor, apple blaster, tater sack slide, shooting gallery, catwalk, firework shows, campfire rentals, flower picking, helicopter rides, and foam parties, weather permitting. Helicopter rides over Fiddlesticks Farms are provided by Rogue Aviation. Tickets range from $40 for children to $50 for adults. Reservations are not allowed, and waivers are required before boarding. Rides are available, weather permitting. Helicopter rides are offered every weekend starting in October. The guests are welcome to bring in food and drinks. However, we opened our cantina in 2018, Norton said. Guests are urged to wear comfortable shoes as well as pack sunscreen and bug spray. The peak weekends in November are the busiest for us, she said. That's why we encourage everyone to come visit us for non-peak weekends. At a glance. What? Fiddlesticks Farms opening weekend. When? September 28th and 29th. Where? 5610 East County Road, 120. How? Tickets available at fiddlesticksfarms.com. Diamondback completes merger with Endeavor. Two Midland-based companies that dominate in the Permian Basin are now one, as Diamondback Energy has completed its $26 billion merger with Endeavor Energy Resources. Announced in February, the merger withstood extensive reviews by the Federal Trade Commission, which also carefully scrutinized ExxonMobil's purchase of Pioneer Natural Resources, Chevron's acquisition of Hess Corporation, and Occidental Petroleum's deal to purchase Crown Rock. The newly combined entity has pro forma production of about 816,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day and total Permian acreage of about 838,000 net acres. We are pleased to announce the closing of this transformative merger, creating a must-own North American independent oil company, said Travis Stice, chairman and chief executive officer of Diamondback, in a statement. Today, Diamondback is not only bigger, but better. Our high-quality inventory, located in the heart of the Permian Basin, gives us the running room to do what we do best, turn rock into cash flow. He continued, I would like to thank our employees for all their hard work in getting this deal across the finish line and welcome the Endeavor employees to the Diamondback team. Together, I am confident we can continue to build off of Diamondback's impressive operational track record of low-cost operations and position the new Diamondback for long-term success. Cluster bomb scare in McCamey turns out to be oil field tool, by B.K. Richter. Upton County. A cluster bomb scare in McCamey created a problem for officials in Upton County this week. Midland police assisted when, at about 9:48 a.m. Monday, they received a request from Upton County Sheriff Sarah Brown. At the time of the call, Brown was already en route to the 300 block of South Crockett, which is located two blocks from a school. Brown responded to what was believed to be a cluster bomb munition. According to a press release from the City of Midland, MPD officials reached out to Dyess Air Force Base Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team in Abilene. Officials at Dyess said it did look like a military munition and were going to start their deployment request process, the city said. Midland Police personnel Kevin Bullard, Michael Poole, Kyle Slagle, and Brian Rackow responded directly to McCamey's bomb scare. Local officials had already taken action and set up a perimeter in the area. Before the team arrived on the scene, Dyess Air Force Base called and said that they believed it was a second stage hydraulic cement collar used to seal a borehole, MPD wrote in a press statement. They guided us on what we should see on the X-ray of the item to help make the determination. Officers Bullard and Poole went downrange for X-rays at approximately 1:08 p.m. X-rays of the object determined that there was no threat and that it was an oil field tool. Midland ISD AFJ ROTC hosted 9/11 event at Centennial Park. Midland ISD's Air Force Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, AFJ ROTC cadets, hosted a remembrance ceremony for the community Wednesday morning at Centennial Park, 200 West Wall Street. The ceremony was under the direction of Chief Master Sergeant Jeffrey Dainzer. This second annual event was free and open to the public. They honored the victims of the 9/11 attacks while engaging in a patriotic memorial event with community members and first responders. The formal ceremony included the presentation of colors, a Midland High School choir performance of the national anthem, a flag display by the Patriot Guard riders, a moment of silence, and the playing of taps. Representatives from the Midland Fire Department and other first responders were also in attendance. Life tributes for Wednesday, September 11th. Donald Rady McCarter. Donald Rady McCarter of Midland died unexpectedly August 28th while in Shelbyville, Tennessee. He was born October 17th, 1944, in Birmingham, Alabama, to the late Rady McCarter and Willodine McCarter Weeks. He is survived by his daughter, Dana Cole Cheshire, and husband, Jean. He has one surviving sister, Joyce McCarter Green, and husband, Jack, of Canton, Georgia, a brother-in-law, Ralph Lyles, and his longtime friend and companion, Linda S. Kirk, of Midland. He's also survived by a granddaughter. He is predeceased by his wife of 35 years, Carol Bozanek McCarter, from South Carolina, and two sisters, Martha Dean Lyles and husband Ralph of Springville, Alabama, and Sandra Ann DeGrado of Trustville, Alabama. Private services are planned in Springville, Alabama, and Midland, Texas. Daisy Jeanette Whitmore Riggs. Daisy Jeanette Whitmore Riggs, 91, of Midland, passed away Friday, September 6th. She was born March 7th, 1933, in Kilgore to Monocure Whitmore and Roberta Daniels. She married Benjamin R. Woods Sr., and they had two daughters and a son. She later married George Washington Riggs. She is predeceased by her husband George, her parents, and brothers Eli Whitmore, M.C. Whitmore, and Israel Whitmore, six sisters, Geraldine Whitmore Nichols, Etta Amy, Louise Ainsworth, Lorraine Lolly, Maureen Whitmore, and Carolyn Whitmore Egwa, and one grandchild. She is survived by her daughters Deborah Woods Morris and husband Paul of Midland, Benjamin R. Woods Jr. and wife Carolyn of DeSoto, and daughter Leisha Woods Grace, Calvin Riggs and wife Faye, and Carolyn Riggs Menefield of Midland, Cassandra Riggs Muth of Mansfield, 15 grandchildren, 24 great-grandchildren, 10 great-great-grandchildren, and a host of nieces, nephews, and cousins. Viewing will be Saturday, September 14th from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. with funeral service to follow at 11 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net or on the website at www.lawalangarciapipkinfh.com. Gracie Shepherd. Gracie Salmon Shepherd passed away Sunday, July 28th, after a brief illness. She is preceded in death by her father, Emilio B. Salmon. Survivors include Jim Shepherd, her husband, her mother, Lupe V. Salmon of San Angelo, brother Jose Salmon and wife Adele from Alpine, sisters Priscilla Estrada and Maria Hendricks, both from San Angelo, also several nieces and nephews.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, September 11th, 2024. Midland Health. Garza wins Daisy Award for Service. Midland Health is excited to announce that Taylor Garza, RN, a dedicated lactation specialist from the Mother-Baby Unit, has been awarded with the Daisy Award. This prestigious recognition is a testament to Garza's extraordinary contributions and unwavering compassion in her role. The Daisy Award for Extraordinary Nurses is a testament to the compassionate and dedicated care nurses provide every day. Established by the Daisy Foundation in memory of J. Patrick Barnes, the award honors nurses who go above and beyond for their patients. To date, Midland Health has recognized over 145 nurses through this program. One of Garza's nominators shared a heartfelt testimonial. Quote, Taylor came to me before leaving her shift and assisted me. She was very knowledgeable, encouraging, and kept me calm throughout. She stayed with me and didn't rush me. Taylor even gave me a backup plan for the night in case it was needed. She went above and beyond to calm my nerves, reduce my stress, and make me comfortable going home tomorrow. She is kind, caring, and compassionate, which is exactly what every new mama needs. End quote. Midland Health's mission is to lead health care for Greater Midland. The Daisy Award for Extraordinary Nurses aligns perfectly with this mission, recognizing the special work that nurses do every day to go above and beyond for their patients. Midland Memorial Hospital presents one special nurse each month with the Daisy Award, and each year, one Daisy nurse leader. Daisy Award criteria. Garza's recognition is a result of meeting the following Daisy Award criteria: providing the highest quality, compassionate care and services to patients, families, and other guests. Exhibiting a positive attitude and outstanding customer service skills. Ensuring safe, reliable care. Advocating strongly for patients and families. Striving to make every patient and family member's experience exceptional. Serving as a role model by representing the profession of nursing and upholding excellence and standards of practice. Displaying integrity, collaboration, professionalism, individual growth, and synergy. Embracing cultural diversity and integrating the patient's personal preferences. Learn about the Daisy Award and how to nominate a nurse at midlandhealth.org. Avian flu, H5N1. Missouri bird flu mystery leaves scientists baffled. A mysterious human case of the H5N1 bird flu was recently discovered in Missouri, and experts are still working to determine how the patient was infected. The avian flu has been circulating among poultry and wild birds since 2022, but made the interspecies jump to dairy cows earlier in 2024. Just over a dozen humans have been infected in the U.S. so far that health officials know about, most of them livestock workers who have made direct contact with sick animals. But that pattern was broken Friday, when the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services announced it found a human case in late August among the general public. The patient reported no contact with animals, leaving experts wondering how they contracted the flu and whether the case suggests that the virus is now traveling between humans. Quote, this is the 14th human case of H5 avian flu reported in the United States during 2024, and the first case of H5 without a known occupational exposure to sick or infected animals, end quote. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention wrote in a press release September 6th. The agency added that the risk of avian flu to the general public remains low. Details about the patient have been sparse to protect their identity, But some experts have found the state and federal response to be frustratingly slow. For instance, while CDC labs confirmed the avian flu diagnosis, the agency's investigators can't look into the infection further unless state authorities request their help. So far, Missouri hasn't made such a request. Quote, "We have not had a need for more extensive on-site assistance at this time, as we are still limited to one case with low risk of sustained transmission," end quote, DHSS spokesperson Lisa Cox wrote in an email. CDC spokesperson Nick Spinelli did not respond to follow-up questions about the agency's further involvement in the Missouri case after its nationwide surveillance program detected it. Here's what we know, and what we don't, about the unusual infection. How did a Missouri resident contract bird flu? Until now, direct contact with infected livestock has caused all the human infections with the H5N1 flu virus during the current outbreak. The Missouri case reported on September 6th is notable because it seems to involve somebody who is not a livestock worker. Quote, "The patient has reported no exposure to animals," end quote, the department's press release reads. But the patient's level of contact with non-livestock animals like pets or wild birds remains unknown. The flu can infect pets like outdoor cats when they come into contact with infected birds or other wild animals. It has already been found in red foxes in Missouri and skunks in Kansas, as well as domestic cats in at least 13 other states, according to the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. Dr. Dana Hawkinson, the medical director for infection prevention and control at the University of Kansas Health System, said that a pet could be responsible for the Missouri infection, but it's hard to say without knowing more about the patient's circumstances. Quote, "I think household pets are probably a fairly good, plausible explanation for this," end quote, he said. Quote, "In general, we just don't have a lot of information about this case," end quote. He added that the most likely vector for the disease is high contact surfaces where the virus can linger. Quote, "Humans in general just touch their face on a regular basis and don't always do the best hand hygiene," end quote, he said. Quote, "I have to believe there was some contamination where this person picked it up by high touch surfaces rather than airborne," end quote. Can the bird flu spread between humans? Historically, there have been some examples of the H5N1 virus spreading between humans, Hawkinson said. However, this type of transmission isn't nearly as likely between people as it is between animals. Quote, "You need to have the receptors and you need to have the virus, which is able to bind to the receptors on our cells to cause infection," end quote, he said. Quote, "Humans tend not to have as much of the receptor for this avian influenza in their body compared to other animals, especially birds," end quote. He added that transmission of the avian flu virus between humans have been limited to just a few people during past outbreaks. While it's possible the recently reported Missouri infection was contracted from another human, the CDC maintains that the virus's risk to the public remains low. Quote, "The main issue is just making sure you're washing your hands after any possible interaction or touching of contaminated surfaces," end quote, Hawkinson said. Quote, "Try to avoid touching your hands to your face," end quote. While human-to-human transmission isn't currently a major concern, the avian flu virus has already mutated enough to make the jump from birds to mammals, and it will likely continue to evolve in the future. "This year's flu shots are not formulated to protect against the H5N1 virus," Hawkinson said. "The government does have a supply of H5N1-specific vaccines, but they currently aren't recommended for most people to use." New rules. Breast cancer screening gets boost. Atlanta. A new federal rule takes effect Tuesday that could potentially help more women spot breast cancer earlier. The FDA will require mammogram providers across the country to notify women if they have dense breast tissue and recommend they consult with their doctor about whether they need additional screening. While many women are unaware of their breast tissue density, about 50% of women getting a mammogram have dense breasts. It's a factor that increases their risk of breast cancer and makes it harder to spot cancer on a mammogram. Here's what all women need to know about dense breast tissue and what to do with this new information. What are the new rules? As of Tuesday, all mammogram reports sent to patients in the U.S. will be required to make a note of whether a woman has dense breasts. Some states, including Georgia, already have existing laws requiring women be notified of their breast density. All mammography centers in the U.S. must comply with this rule by Tuesday. But the American Cancer Society notes many are already doing so. What does it mean to have dense breasts? Breast density is a measure of how much fibrous and glandular tissue there is in your breast as compared to fat tissue. It isn't related to breast size or firmness. What will your mammogram report say about density? The summary of the mammogram reports given to patients will be described as either, quote, not dense, end quote, or, quote, dense, end quote. While the exact wording can vary slightly, if your breast tissue is dense, your report will say, quote, breast tissue can be either dense or not dense. Dense tissue makes it harder to find breast cancer on a mammogram and also raises the risk of developing breast cancer. Your breast tissue is dense. In some people with dense tissue, other imaging tests in addition to a mammogram may help find cancers. Talk to your healthcare provider about breast density, risk for breast cancer, and your individual situation, end quote. Why is breast density important? Breast density is important for two main reasons. One, dense breast tissue makes it harder for radiologists to see cancer on mammograms. Dense breast tissue looks white on a mammogram. Breast masses and cancers can also look white, so the dense tissue can make it harder to see them. In contrast, fatty tissue looks almost black on a mammogram, so it's easier to spot a tumor that looks white if most of the breast is fat tissue. More than 33% of breast cancers are missed by mammography in women with dense breasts, according to estimates by George Washington University Hospital. Two, women who have dense breast tissue have a higher risk of breast cancer compared to women with less dense tissue, according to ACS. It's unclear at this time why dense breast tissue is linked to cancer risk. It may be that it has more cells than can develop into abnormal or cancerous cells. The more dense your breasts are, the higher your risk, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The level of risk is thought to be similar to the risk of breast cancer in someone who has a relative who had the disease, according to the Mayo Clinic. How do you know if you have dense breasts? Radiologists are doctors who, quote, read, end quote, mammograms and other types of imaging tests. They check your mammogram for abnormal areas, and they also look at breast density. Is there more for you to know? Doctors break down breast density into four categories, from almost all fatty tissue, category A, to scattered areas of dense tissue, category B, to heterogeneously dense, category C, to extremely dense, category D. Mammogram reports sent to healthcare providers must include an overall assessment of breast density using the four categories. The summary report given to patients may not specify the level of density. But if you have access to your report through a patient portal or other means, you can often find this within the report, usually near the beginning of the report. If you do not have access to the report, you can ask your provider for this information. What should you do if you have dense breast tissue? If your mammogram report says that you have dense breast tissue, talk with your healthcare provider about what this means for you and whether you should get additional tests. Some studies have suggested 3D mammography might be particularly helpful in women with dense breasts. A 3D mammogram uses computers to combine X-ray pictures of the breast into a 3D image, which allows healthcare professionals to see past densities better. It can be used as a screening test along with or instead of a standard mammogram, although it isn't yet available at all imaging centers. Studies have also shown that breast ultrasound and possibly magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, can also help find some cancers that can't be seen on mammograms. But ultrasound and MRI can also lead to false positives that are not cancer. That in turn can lead to more tests and unnecessary biopsies. How much will extra screenings cost? The cost of an ultrasound or MRI may not be covered by insurance for women with dense breast tissue. Medical associations have issued statements on dense breasts, but so far have not issued clear advice on what doctors and women should do with the new density information.
This is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, September 10th. New Mexico comes up big with oil. Average of 2 million barrels per day boosts state's prominence. New Mexico has emerged as a major player in the Permian Basin's oil and natural gas production, with Lee and Eddy counties becoming particularly prominent. The Permian Basin Petroleum, Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners, and Texas Oil and Gas Association say the development has made the Permian even stronger than it already was, although New Mexico's state regulatory environment remains burdensome. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says New Mexico's output increased when companies began tapping the heretofore less developed Delaware Basin under the Permian there, bolstering the region's record 5.77 million barrels per day of oil production from 3.3 million barrels per day in 2022 and 4.7 million barrels per day in 2021. The production coming from New Mexico has been incredible for the state, the Permian Basin, and the energy security of our nation, PBPA President Ben Shepherd said. Because of the production in Lee, Eddy, Chavez, and Roosevelt counties, New Mexico is now the second largest oil-producing state in the country, only behind Texas, and revenue generated by the oil and gas industry now provides for roughly half of New Mexico's state budget. Education, road construction, and health care are just a few of the government services in every corner of New Mexico that are supported by revenues from oil and gas production from the Permian Basin. But without better support from the New Mexico state government, Shepherd said, it's questionable how long these levels can be maintained. Even with the realized growth in production, companies face new regulatory, legislative, and even litigation challenges, which serve to limit, if not deter, operations in the state, he said. The rock is incredible in New Mexico, but the barriers to oil and gas development are high and seem to be growing higher. Hobbs is in Lee County, Carlsbad in Eddy County, Roswell in Chavez County, and Portales in Roosevelt County. TIPRO President Ed Longenecker said, Lee and Eddy hold tremendous potential as the region continues to reach new milestones. While approximately 78% of production comes from the Texas side of the Permian Basin on an oil barrel of oil equivalent basis, many prominent Texas-based operators are expanding their investments into New Mexico, Longenecker said from Austin. Of the top 10 operators by wells drilled this year in New Mexico, 9 are headquartered in Texas. The regulatory environment in New Mexico is more stringent than in Texas, but the region is expected to grow in importance from an economic and energy security perspective, helping to counter the call for more burdensome regulations in the future. He said that there has been an uptick in upstream exploration and production employment in Lee and Eddy counties, with the addition of nearly 3,300 jobs to a total of 13,619 between 2021 and 2023. That's still below the high of 15,437 upstream jobs reached in 2019, Longenecker said. During that same time frame, the direct gross regional product increased by 85% in the Lee and Eddy counties upstream sector to $7,161,600,820, citing the EIA. TXOGA chief economist Dean Foreman said, Lee and Eddy drove New Mexico's crude oil production to over 2 million barrels per day in June, alongside a record high of 9.6 billion cubic feet per day of natural gas marketed production. These achievements would not have been possible without the infrastructure and market access provided by Texas, Foreman said. As New Mexico's production has expanded, Texas has consistently received over 2 million barrels per day of oil for 7 consecutive months in 2024, or double the volume from 2020. He said Texas's extensive pipeline network processing facilities and refining capacity have been pivotal in supporting New Mexico's growth. The Permian Basin's prolific output enables Texas refiners and blenders to utilize a record high 5.77 million barrels per day of crude oil while exporting 3.8 million barrels per day in June, reinforcing Texas's position as a global leader in energy supply, Foreman said. Vote for the best Rita at the West Texas Margarita Festival. The West Texas Margarita Festival, presented by Texas Festivals, will be at Fair to Midland, 1115 Tradewinds Boulevard in Midland, from noon to 6 p.m. September 14th. Margarita lovers can go around and sample more than 8 margaritas from West Texas's best bars and restaurants and vote for their favorite. Here's how it works. Purchase a sampling ticket at www.texasfest.com. Receive a margarita sampling card and voting chip upon entry. Go around to 8-plus booths and sample over 8 margaritas from various restaurants. Drop a voting chip in your favorite margarita's voting jar. The jar with the most chips will be crowned best margarita in West Texas. In addition to offering a margarita lover's dream lineup, the festival will have street tacos, food trucks, an adult playground, live DJ, and plenty of market vendors. So guests can fiesta like there's no mañana all day long. One lucky partygoer will win an all-inclusive trip to New Mexico. Every sampling ticket purchased gives you one entry. Every VIP ticket gives you 2 entries, and additional raffle tickets are $5, with 100% of the proceeds going toward children's charities. The winner will be drawn at 6:15 p.m. Sampling admission includes a sampling card for 8-plus margarita samples, 1 voting chip, and 1 raffle entry to win the trip to Mexico. VIP sampling is also available and includes access beginning at noon as opposed to 3 p.m., speedy entry to the festival all day, a sampling card, 1 voting chip, and 2 raffle entries. Partygoers must be 21 or over to attend. Dogs of all ages are also welcome. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit www.texasfests.com. Tropical storm Francine forms off Mexico and is expected to hit Louisiana as a hurricane. Tropical storm Francine formed in the Gulf of Mexico on Monday and is expected to drench the Texas coast with rain before coming ashore in Louisiana as a hurricane on Wednesday night. We are going to have a very dangerous situation developing by the time we get into Wednesday for portions of the north central Gulf Coast, primarily along the coast of Louisiana, where we're going to see the potential for life-threatening storm surge inundation and hurricane-force winds, said Michael Brennan, director of the U.S. National Hurricane Center in Miami. Heavy rain has already been falling in northeastern Mexico and deep south Texas, where some places could get up to 12 inches into Monday night, Brennan said. Francine is taking aim at a stretch of coastline that has yet to fully recover since Hurricanes Laura and Delta decimated Lake Charles, Louisiana in 2020, followed a year later by Hurricane Ida. Over the weekend, a 22-story building in Lake Charles that had become a symbol of the destruction was imploded while sitting vacant for nearly 4 years, its window shattered and covered in shredded tarps. The storm surge pushed by Francine could reach as much as 10 feet along a stretch of Louisiana coastline from Cameron to Port Fourchon and into Vermilion Bay, and if the current track holds, the storm could blow northward up the Mississippi River into the Illinois area by Saturday. Francine is expected to bring multiple days of heavy rainfall, considerable flash flooding risk, Brennan said. Residents of Baton Rouge, Louisiana's riverfront capital, began forming long lines as people filled up their gas tanks and stocked up on groceries. Others went to fill sandbags at city-operated locations, but to try to keep floodwaters from entering their homes. It's crucial that all of us take this storm very seriously and begin our preparations immediately, Baton Rouge Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom said during a news conference Monday morning. She urged residents to prepare a disaster supply kit, complete with enough food, water, and essential supplies for 3 days. The Hurricane Center said Monday morning that Francine was located about 245 miles southeast of the mouth of the Rio Grande and about 480 miles south-southeast of Cameron, Louisiana, sustaining a top wind of up to 50 miles per hour. The storm is expected to be centered just offshore through Tuesday and then intensify significantly from Tuesday night into Wednesday as it nears the upper Texas coast and Louisiana, according to the Hurricane Center. A storm surge watch has been issued from just east of Galveston to the Mississippi-Alabama border, while a hurricane watch has been issued for much of the Louisiana coast from Cameron to Grand Isle. County holding news conference Monday afternoon. Fawcett wants disaster declaration at container fire site. Ector County Judge Dustin Fawcett is holding a news conference Monday afternoon at 1:30 at the Ector County Courthouse to discuss a declaration of disaster for Ector County due to a commercial fire located in northwest Odessa at 8100 North County Road West, a site with significant oil field-related chemicals. The fire and recent flooding in Ector County has significantly affected the residences, air and water quality in the surrounding areas. In a news release, Fossa said, after discussion with our state partners, including State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Texas Department of Emergency Management, and Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, as well as with constituents who live in the area most affected by the recent fire and floods, we are all in agreement that state assistance is needed to ensure Ector County residents' property and health are both protected moving forward. Fawcett, Ector County Emergency Management Director Wes Carta, City of Odessa City Manager John Beckmeyer, Odessa Fire Chief Jason Cotton, Ector County Commissioner Precinct 1 Mike Gardner, and the Permian Basin Chapter of the American Red Cross's Executive Director Tracy Austin will attend. County submits disaster declaration in wake of PBC blaze. In the wake of the fire and flooding at the site of Permian Basin Containers, Ector County has submitted a disaster declaration request to unlock state resources to help people living in the affected area. The request was submitted to the Texas Department of Emergency Management, and a letter was sent to Governor Greg Abbott. Ector County Judge Dustin Fawcett said reimbursement is possible, but there are a lot of variables to that. Permian Basin Containers was located at 8100 North County Road West. A fire and recent flooding in Ector County has significantly affected the residents' air and water quality in the surrounding areas, a news release detailed. It also has caused health issues for residents. After discussing with our state partners, including State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Texas Department of Emergency Management, and Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, as well as with constituents who live in the area mostly affected by the recent fire and floods, we are all in agreement that state assistance is needed to ensure Ector County residents' property and health are both protected moving forward, County Judge Dustin Fawcett said in a news release. Fawcett said they were getting to the point where they had concerns of the fire lingering and the continuing issue of hotspots, which Odessa Fire Rescue has repeatedly beaten back in the more than a month since the fire. But then also we've been seeing some concerning water testing levels, and those have been some independent tests alongside what we had Texas A&M AgriLife do. So we're seeing some of those issues with the fire quality tests. And now we're having some air quality issues after the flood. We don't know what it stirred up, but it wasn't good, Fawcett said, before a Monday news conference outside the Ector County courtroom. He doesn't know what was in the fire, but there are petrochemicals involved. That's our biggest concern, is whenever you start seeing the ones like benzene or any of those types of hydrocarbon-related products coming through in your water, that's where there's an issue, Fawcett said. We ran some tests and it was published that they were talking about organics like E. coli and all of those that were at your normal levels. That's not what we're worried about. We know what's in our typical water. What we are concerned about is anything like hydrocarbon-related petrochemicals. And when you start seeing that, there's definitely an issue. We want to identify if we are at hazardous levels to mitigate it, he added. Fawcett said they have had probably a dozen residents in the area that have contacted State Commissioner Mike Gardner, Ector County Emergency Management Director Russ Carta, a state representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, about these issues. W. Nim Kidd, Texas Department of Emergency Management Chief, had a conversation with Landgraf and was asked about the PBC situation, Fawcett said. So at that point, I realized it's best to bring in the state. Really, all of this disaster declaration does is invite them in. They will not come in unless they're invited, and you do that via the emergency declaration, Fawcett said. He added that they can do additional testing if they are seeing concerning levels of chemicals in the air or with water, then those issues can be addressed and they can help bring drinking water to residents. We have different stations throughout the state with significant amounts of drinking water that we can ship in and we can have available to them at no cost to the residents. And we can provide additional resources to them, living situations and everything else, Fawcett said. Also, he said there is still a massive cleanup to do with the flood, so it's kind of two-in-one situation, Fawcett said. On August 27th, nearly two dozen people living at Golder Avenue, West Hillmont, 81st and 83rd Streets, and one business filed a lawsuit against Permian Basin Containers, alleging the company was an environmental disaster waiting to happen. And the recent fires there have caused them to suffer ill health effects, lose their water well, and suffer property damage. According to the lawsuit filed in Ector County District Court, the plaintiffs are also demanding potable water be delivered to their homes in the short term, and in the long term, proper remediation and testing of groundwater and well water. They also want air testing, the removal of toxic and harmful debris, the remediation of their property and their health issues to be remedied, the lawsuit stated. The lawsuit states that well water is outside TCEQ's jurisdiction, so no state agency is testing the water, and those doing the testing for Ector County don't test for dangerous chemicals. Fawcett said Monday that, to his understanding, PBC has not been operating, but they have been in contact with the remediation crews that have been working there through TCEQ. No one is sure of the cause of the fire. OFR Chief Jason Cotton noted that it's not their jurisdiction to investigate because the site is in the county. Fawcett said whether people in the area need personal protective equipment is one of the conversations that will be had. We're kind of in a no man's land at this point. We thought that we could have better results by this point. We just simply don't. We thought there would be a better remediation effort, and there's not. Representative Landgraf has been all over. He's done a tremendous job. So has our emergency management team. So has OFR in addressing the hotspots. Everybody's done a very good job. This is one that you want to be overly precautious when it comes to people's health. And that's really the situation on this one. A disaster declaration seems drastic, but really we need to look out for the health and welfare of our residents, Fawcett said. During the news conference, he said his message to people living in the area is that they should not have to be going through this. Everything that's happening is through no fault of their own, other than owning a home near where the site is of this fire that took place. They did not deserve this, and it is the role of government to come in and try to provide the resources possible. So that's what we are doing. We hear their calls. We received those phone calls, and especially as it pertains to the health concerns that have popped up in recent days, whenever we start hearing that there are health concerns of our constituents, you better believe we move here in Ector County. We're going to move and make decisions that benefit those citizens. I'm proud of the efforts that have been ongoing for the past month. Now it's time we need to elevate that, specifically after this flooding. We're on it. We're going to leave no paper unturned, and we are going to make sure that they get the resources they need to where they feel comfortable that they are living in healthy conditions. Ultimately, that's the goal, Fawcett said. For the past 48 days, Micah Hancock and her family have been living out of a camper at Wheeler Drilling and Water Service. Hancock lives at 720 East 81st, and her mother lives at 716 West 81st Street. Being at or near home causes vomiting, headaches, and dizziness, among other symptoms, Hancock said. When they move things around, it would get a little better, but their air monitors would go off. The smell has infiltrated her car, and she says she smells like an oilfield worker. She noted that no one is helping them with expenses. Her mother's water tested fine, but she hasn't got her results back yet. One of their neighbors is gone, her driveway is blocked off, and another neighbor's house burned down. Hancock said Landgraf had the West Texas Food Bank bring in a stack of water. She said the company owner paid for a hotel for 2 days, but they have been living out of their cars and a camper since then. Hancock said she has no idea if the disaster declaration will help. She contacted the Red Cross, but was told to call the Salvation Army or a homeless shelter. She and her mother, her daughter, two dogs, and a cat. Mostly, she just wants to know when she can go home. I think they just got it cleaned up. We could go home. The smell will go away, Hancock said.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.